Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have you here as always. Now, my guest today is someone who's incredibly fascinating. Michael Bungay-Stanier is a Rhodes Scholar. He's the author of many books, and his two most recent books called The Coaching Habit and The Advice Trap have had a profound impact on the way I see things and think about things, and certainly impacted my work. And you might be thinking, well, that's interesting for you, Jesse. You're a coach, but what does that mean for me? Well, the short answer is quite a lot, actually. If you're looking to have a team that is self-sufficient, if you're looking to create leverage in your practice and be able to scale up and to be able to have your time used for its highest and best use, then having a team is going to be fundamental to that. And of course, if you're going to have a team, it's about having a team that performs well at the highest level, is able to be autonomous and self-sufficient, as I've mentioned. And that means these coaching skills, the coaching habits, are going to be essential as you develop your leadership. It's not so much about being a coach in a sense, but it's about taking the elements of coaching and incorporating those into your leadership attributes. It's about avoiding the advice trap, because as dentists, we're wired to give advice. But when it comes to building a team, it's actually counterproductive. It doesn't serve us. So in this conversation, Michael talks a lot about all of those elements of leadership and how to be more effective as a leader. Michael is an interesting guy, as I've said. He's a renegade. He's someone who thinks outside the box. And being a Rhodes Scholar, he's obviously very, very bright. But what I love is the intellectual rigor that comes with this, coupled with the ability to see things differently and to think outside the box, as I said. So I believe this is a show that you're going to want to listen to a couple of times through, because there's a lot of pearls of wisdom that Michael shares that you want to come back and listen to a few times to really integrate and embed those. But for now, I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Michael as much as I enjoyed recording it. Here he is.
Michael, thanks so much for taking the time to come and join us all the way from Canada today. How's things over on the other side of the planet?
Pretty good. I mean, it's cold. You know, it's like minus 20 or something with wind chill, which, you know, I grew up in Canberra, so I thought I knew what cold was relative to the rest of Australia, because you'd have all these, you know, Sydney siders complaining about how cold it was at 15 degrees. And I'm like, oh yeah, in Canberra, it drops down to 3 degrees. And now I'm like, oh, in Canada, it drops down to minus 30, which means it's so cold that if you take a glass of water and you throw it in the air, it's frozen before it hits the land. That's how cold it can get. So,
wow.
You know, I don't love winter, but my wife does. So one of the reasons we're here in Canada is that she's in her happy spot when things are cold outside.
That's fantastic, because I'm a Queenslander originally, and when I first came to Canberra, it was endless moaning about the winter. And my wife grew up in Canberra. You'll appreciate this, but probably seems a little bit soft now that you've just told that story. She grew up in Canberra without central heating.
Right.
And so in the morning, you kind of throw the covers off, run to the shower, do the dash. And so my wedding gift to her was central heating. And
you old romantic, you. I mean, seriously. They say romance is dead. And you went, no, I could get you flowers. I could get you jewelry. But no, I'm not getting you any of that. I'm getting you central heating.
Too right, mate. And I tell you, I reckon it's been the best thing for our marriage too.
Yeah.
So anyway, look, it's great to have you here, mate. And I really wanted just to start by saying how much I've appreciated your work. I know you've authored more books than the ones I'm holding up here. And yeah. I'm holding up the two books. The first one is called The Coaching Habit, and the second one is called The Advice Trap.
Yeah.
Wonderful books. I've read them. And in fact, we use them as a teaching resource for our team as well. So
love hearing that.
Yeah, they're great.
I spent 3 years trying to get The Coaching Habit published with a New York publisher who I worked with before, and I just didn't like the idea. And I was finally got to a point where I'm like, you know what? I swear this is a good idea, and I'm going to self-publish it. So yeah. I self-published it 5 years ago, it's gone on to sell about 1 million copies. And I feel not only successful because of that book and hearing stories like yours, but smug as well, right? Because now I'm like, see, I told you this was a good book, but you passed on it, so it'd be it.
So be it, exactly. But I'm pretty sure they're going to knock on your door anytime soon, mate. So,
exactly. I'm happy to have that conversation and then explain why we shan't be working together again.
Have faith in me, and if you don't, that's okay. Yeah, but I'm moving on. Yeah,
exactly. Cool. Right.
So I wanted to ask you about the impetus for writing those books. You've written several books. I've only written one, and I was interested to note on your website that you said every time you write a book, you feel like, I'm done. It's painful. I don't want to do it again. And I totally understand that feeling. I've only just come back to writing my second. But what prompted you after writing other books and so many books to address this topic in particular?
Well, so there's two questions there. Why address this topic and why write a book about it?
Yeah.
And it's useful to separate them out because one of the ways you can contribute to making a better world is to share new insight or new wisdom around a topic, find a solution to a problem people have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why people like you and me start podcasts. We're like, get to talk to interesting people, get to spread news around, create a brand, create some intellectual property, perhaps. That all can contribute both to a better world, but also can help you scale your reach and your influence and your business perhaps as well. So there's really good reason to be creating beyond just yourself. And, you know, in fact, one of the telling moments of trying to grow my own business was hearing somebody explain that there are three roles that you go through as you grow a business. The first is you identify with the profession. You say, I am a dentist. And that means you're kind of technically entwined with the role of dentistry or whatever else the role is, but dentistry seems a good example right now. The second level is you go, I am an entrepreneur who practices dentistry. And that opens up a whole nother world of thinking because it's like, sure, dentistry is a technical skill, but being the entrepreneur is how I scale a business, market a business, make a profit, grow a franchise. Is kind of, it takes you to a whole nother way of thinking about what you do and how you self-identify. And then the third level is I create IP around dentistry. And as you go through those three levels, your ability to scale and have impact and make a difference increases. So the ability to create intellectual property is really powerful, and both in terms of the reach you have and also and the money you can make if you're driven by the money. The next part of your question, which is like, why write a book? And that's a really good question because book writing is, for the most part, bloody awful and hard and miserable and lonely. And it's actually pretty easy to write a really average book. It's quite hard to write a really good book. You go through iteration after iteration, draft after draft. And then more than 90% of books sell well under 1,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that you've now spent 100 hours of your life minimum getting in front of 1,000 people who are a bit underwhelmed by your book because most of them don't even finish it.
Yep.
So it's a really good question to go, is a book a good idea? And honestly, for most people, it's not.
Yep.
Now, it depends on your motivation, of course, because there are some people who go, look, it matters to me to say that I'm an author and I just want a book. And honestly, I don't mind that I've got 750 copies of my 800 print run in the garage and I'm going to give them out for Christmas presents to people for the rest of their lives or rest of my life. But I have a book, and damn it, that's awesome. And that's the success. But for me, I write a book because A, I like writing, or at least I don't dislike writing, and I know what my voice is with writing. Mm. Secondly, writing a book for me is a challenge, but I've written 6 or 7 books, so I know how to navigate it, so I know how to kind of grit my way through it.
Mm.
Thirdly, I know where my book fits into my business ecosystem. So, you know, I'm an entrepreneur as well. So, you know, The Coaching Habit, which has sold like 1 million copies. So that's amazing. And I'll probably never have another book that sells that many copies ever again. And I knew when I was writing that book that if I could get 10 copies of that book into the right people's hands, I could point to somewhere between $1 and $10 million of revenue for my training company.
Yeah, nice.
So part of it is like, you know what? It doesn't matter really if the book sells a lot to individuals. Now it becomes a sophisticated marketing tool, I hope, that helps drive success for the business. So that's a very long answer to your question about why write a book, but all of that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in there. And again, it's coming back to one of the things that you touched on is that they're gritting your way through it. And look, I find when I write, it forces clarity of thought. It forces you to organize your thoughts in a somewhat linear fashion, to take something that's a little bit amorphous, a little bit kind of everywhere, and create a pathway. And that takes a bit of discipline and takes a lot of, well, frankly, hard work.
Yeah, it is hard. There's that quote around from, I can't remember, it's like on the Supreme Court of the American, you know, Supreme Court. One of the justices said, look, I don't care for simplicity on this side of complexity, but I would give anything for simplicity on the other side of complexity. But it's hard to get to that, right? Because you've got to work your way through the complexity, and you've got to discard stuff, and you've got to polish, and you've got to work it and rework it. And only then do you get to that place where you're like, ah, I finally figured out how to express this cleanly and clearly and with impact and in a way that feels different and interesting.
Yeah.
And when people read a book and they go, God, that was so easy to read. I really enjoyed it. It was a fast, good, easy read. It's like, that's because the person has written it 4,000 times to make it just so.
Yeah, exactly. It's the old story. I think it was Mark Twain. I can't remember. I'm going to horribly misquote someone. I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time. And I think it's wonderful.
It's either Mark Twain or Oscar Wilde, or maybe both of them.
Maybe both of them. Maybe if they
we never saw, whoever saw Oscar Wilde and Mark Twain in the same room at the same time, right? So, I don't mean to start a rumor, but you know, were they different people?
Maybe, maybe not. Exactly. I wanted to just talk about curiosity for a second. And you've got a wonderful quote on your website, and I read it. It made me smile. and the quote is, curiosity is insubordination in its purest form. And attributed to Vladimir Nabokov, I think is how
Nabokov, to pronounce it. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Can you just talk me through that?
Well, I love it because I am naturally somebody who likes to zag when other people are zigging. So I like to imagine myself as a bit of a kind of maverick, is a bit too of a kind of overblown word, but just a bit different. So for me, it's around, oh, here's how it goes. But I think it speaks fundamentally to the power and the concern people have around curiosity. Because at its best, curiosity says, is this really the thing? Is this really the thing we should be trying to solve? Is this really the best way of doing this thing? Is this really as good as it gets? And all of those ways of starting some form of revolution, at a big scale or at a small scale, so a form of insubordination. But the truth is, lots of us are quite invested in the status quo. So we're like, I don't actually want a whole lot to change. I don't want people asking questions of me. You know, if you're a leader, if you're leading a dentistry practice or whatever, you don't want, or do you, people challenging you, asking questions, going, is this really the vision? Is this really the best strategy? Is this really the tactical plan for rolling this out? So there's always this tension between, at Box of Crayons, which is this training company I started, we talk about the difference between troublemaker curiosity, which is kind of the curiosity that killed the cat, and changemaker curiosity, which is the curiosity that opens you up to new perspectives, helps you stay more focused on trying to figure out what really matters and what's the key problems to solve.
Yeah, so I think that's a really, really good distinction, actually, because I think when we hear the word insubordination, to my mind, I think troublemaker, but it's different to changemaker, and I really, really like that distinction that you're making there. I wanted to look at this in a couple of different frames, a couple of different lenses. But for people listening to this, the person listening to this show is typically going to be a dental practice owner. They're going to be you know, running their small to medium-sized enterprise. They can have a team, patients, all the rest of it. And we spoke a little bit off air. You've spent your fair share of time in dental chair, so you've got a good understanding of how the place operates, right?
I have some understanding, yeah. I'm not sure it's a good understanding. If I tried to explain how it worked, you'd probably go, you have clearly no idea of how it run, what it takes to run a practice. But I'm an entrepreneur, and I have sat in dentistry chairs, so let's just pretend I do know what's going on.
All right, let's use that as our working hypothesis. I wanted to just talk a little bit about coaching and curiosity and understanding, asking questions and understanding how to create quality questions and why the quality of that question is going to hopefully lead to better outcomes. Compared to, I guess, master and commander type leadership, yeah, which is I'm in charge, do it as I say, routine. So I wonder if we could just begin our conversation by talking a little bit about where curiosity fits into leadership and then juxtaposing that against more traditional views of leadership.
Sure. So I would ask everybody who has a senior role in a dentistry practice or is a owner and is running it, I would ask you to take stock of how it's all working for you. And I've got three questions to ask you. The first is this. Are you happy with how dependent your team is on you? Because I think one of the vicious circles that we can find ourselves in is an over-dependent team. They come to you for answers, so you give them answers because you're trying to be helpful. So they come to you for more answers, so you give them more answers. And then before you know it, they seem to come to you for everything. They've somehow lost the capacity to be autonomous and self-sufficient and make decisions. You're trying to help them, but for some reason they're now overly dependent on you. They're kind of honestly sucking you dry a little bit.
Yep.
That's the over-dependent team. Okay. Second vicious circle is a sense of overwhelm. Like the more that ends up on your plate, the more you lose focus on what really matters. So the more that ends up on your plate. So as well as your duties as a dentist during the day, you've got all your duties of running a practice throughout the day. And then at the start of the day, before anybody else has got up, and at the end of the day, while everybody else has gone home, and you're thinking to yourself, man, you know, it's like it's a 50-hour-a-week business being a dentist, and it's a 50-hour-a-week business running a dentistry. And I am endlessly busy and I'm endlessly overwhelmed.
Yep.
So that might, I don't know if that's true, but
it's absolutely true. Nailed it.
Yeah. And then there's a sense of disconnect from why am I doing this? Because did I read somewhere once that like suicide is particularly high amongst dentists? Yes. Is that the truth? Right. So there's a way that you're like, I've lost a connection to the purpose about why I do this work and why it matters to me, but you're in the kind of the grind and you're like, become a small cog in my own machine. What the hell happened here? So if any of those feel real or true to you, then it might be worth saying to yourself, so should I just carry on leading and running this business the way I've been doing it so far? And hope that I just get through it, you know, grit it out, or should I try and do something differently as a result of that?
Mm.
I think one of the great acts of being more coach-like, and you don't have to be a coach because you're a dentist or you're a founder or an entrepreneur. You don't have to be a coach, but you could be more coach-like. And by that, I mean a behavior which is, can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving a little bit more slowly? So that's it. Can you just stay curious a bit longer? And most people are terrible at that. Most people are advice giving maniacs. And I'm going to say people who have some sort of version of medical training are even worse.
Yeah.
Because you guys strut around in white coats. You've got dangerous implements sticking out of your pockets. You've got fancy glasses you wear. Your very business depends on your status and your authority as an expert.
Mm-hmm.
You've invested years and money to get trained so you know what you're talking about. So you're really vested in this idea of, yeah, I'm actually the authority here. I know stuff. This is why people, I have patients because of my expertise.
Yeah.
And if your expertise becomes the way that you now lead, you become the bottleneck, you become exhausted, you have an over-dependent team, you become overwhelmed. So the question I've got for you is another long answer. So sorry, Jesse. But the question you've got here is to go, how do I push authority to the level it best fits in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I bet for all sorts of reasons, you have too much authority and too much responsibility. And part of that comes from a leadership style that you could call master and commander, you know, command and control. Mm-hmm. Russell Crowe striding around on the ship with tight leggings on going, sail over here. So there's a power of being more coach-like because it solves three things. First of all, when you leap in with the answer, particularly in the kind of broader sense out of your very narrow technical expertise, first is you don't always know what's really going on. You think that the first challenge that shows up is the real challenge, and often, quite frankly, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it is,
yeah.
Second reason that you should slow down on the advice is actually your advice isn't as good as you think it is. And you know, you have all sorts of cognitive biases that are telling you that actually all of your advice is golden. It's like, you know, magisterial. But quite frankly, it's a bit dated. It's a bit kind of biased. It's a bit based on what you did back in 1993 when you were young and new and learning your trade. And the stuff that you know for sure, they've already Googled and they can find a better answer faster than the way you can explain it anyway. But even if, just for the sake of argument, Jesse, you know what the real problem is and you've got a stellar answer to it, that third act is leadership, which is like, what if you could encourage the people in your practice to grow, to take responsibility, to figure out stuff themselves, so you're actually growing the capacity and the confidence and the autonomy and the self-sufficiency of the people in your practice. So you break those three vicious circles. You have a team that's less dependent on you and more autonomous, so less reliant on you. You're less overwhelmed because you've pushed and delegated the right things to the right people and you've got people working on the stuff that matters. And you're more connected to the reason you do this business, which is that I'm here to serve, and whatever that is for you. It's like, I'm here to grow my business and dominate the south coast of Australia's dentistry practices, or I'm here to be a technical expertise, or I'm here to specialize in a certain form of dentistry. Yeah, you'll have your own purpose, your own why, but this will allow you to get back to that and make connections to that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think as I'm hearing you say and explain all of that, I'm listening to them going, that is absolutely wonderful. There's so many reasons why we should remain curious and we should avoid getting into, I think you call it the advice monster.
Yeah, advice trap, yeah.
Advice trap.
Taming your advice monster so you stay out of the advice trap, yeah.
Yeah, and so the thing that I wanted to ask you specifically around that is, you're absolutely right, you've nailed dentists pretty well. We get paid to give advice. We are proud of the advice that we give. It comes with the status. It comes with, so there's years and years of habit.
Yeah.
And so what I wanted to ask you is, how do you slowly unwind that habit when your first instinct, your training, your everything, and I don't know whether it's nature or nurture, to be honest with you, it could be a bit of both, is to go down the advice path. How do you catch yourself and go, hang on, I'm about to fall into the advice trap?
So I'll quote I'll allude to it because I don't know the details well enough to quote it, but there's a study that says most GPs interrupt their patients after 18 seconds or less, on average 18 seconds. I honestly don't think GPs are that much worse than most managers and leaders in all sorts of non-medical contexts, but for sure. And I bet that is not untrue for the dentist experience. Because when I go into a dentist and the dentist goes, hey, so what's going on? And I'll say something and the dentist goes, okay, good, let's take a look at that then. And we're into it. But there's all sorts of flaws with the patient-doctor model, and you will know this far better than I'll know it. But, you know, you can't trust a patient. We don't know anything. Like, we don't know what's really going on in our mouth. We don't know what tooth is really hurting. We've already gone on to Dr. Google, so we've already come up with our assumption of what's actually what the problem is and what the solution is. I'm not actually telling you about the rash on my inner thigh because I'm just embarrassed about that. And I'm not going to hope that that never comes up. I'm hoping it's got nothing to do with the thing that's going on in my mouth. It's like, we don't know what the hell's going on. We are as unreliable as you could be sitting in that chair. And of course, you're unreliable as well because you're like, I heard something that sets off pattern recognition, which yep. means that as soon as you say that, I'm like, oh, it's definitely the thing again.
Yeah.
So I do know how to build new habits. I don't know which of these is most useful for the people listening in. But
let's just throw some stuff on the wall and see what sticks.
Here's the generic answer, which is start small.
Mm.
So in the coaching habit book, you know, I just say, look, here are 7 questions. And you don't need to master all of the 7 questions instantly. It's like pick a question and see which one feels like it would be most useful. But then it's like before you pick a question, pick a context. Are you looking to be more coach-like with your head of, I don't know, what do you call it, director of operations in your practice?
Yeah, head practice manager or business manager.
Perfect. So you go, right, I'm going to build a new type of relationship with my business manager or my practice manager. I'm going to be more coach-like with them. So which of these questions and which of this habit building feels most useful for that? Pick a question with them.
Mm.
Or you may go, I really want to mentor a dentist technician, if that's the right word. So now I'm going to, instead of telling them stuff, I'm going to ask them questions around what they're doing and how they're learning. So they're forced to take responsibility, figure stuff out on their own. Or maybe you're like, you know what? I'm going to see if I can stay curious for an extra minute before I start giving patients the benefit of my hard-won wisdom. I'm going to figure out 2 good questions that I can ask patients to see if we can go a little further into the conversation. So, you know, when a patient comes in and lies in your chair and you go, what's going on? And they go, blah, blah, blah. Instead of you going, well, pattern recognition, it's definitely the L1 upper right tooth or whatever you guys say.
Yeah.
You go, great, what else? What else is going on? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, and they may have another answer. And then you go, that's okay, what else? What else is on your mind in terms of how I could be most helpful? And now you're into a slightly different conversation and you get to just practice a little bit and experiment with some of it. You can't listen to this podcast and think to yourself, oh my God, Michael is a genius. I see the error of my ways. This is brilliant. I'm now going to change the way I lead my dentistry practice and I'm going to move to this coach-like dentistry god. I mean, it'd be awesome if you could, but it just won't happen like that. Behavior change is harder than that.
Yeah, it is.
So you go, right. First of all, you need to decide whether the pain is great enough for you to change. Mm-hmm. And if you're like, honestly, Michael, I'm perfectly happy with the way things are. I tell my practice manager what to do. I listen to my patients or I pretend to, and then I tell them what I'm going to do to them anyway, and it's fine. So that person's probably stopped listening to the podcast already, It doesn't really matter. But if you're thinking to yourself, honestly, I want to reconnect with my love of dentistry,
mm-hmm.
or I want to empower my practice manager so that she or he becomes brilliant and really takes ownership, or I want to reinvent how I interact with patients because it's become a bit of a treadmill, then you're like, pick one of those and then go, how can I bring curiosity into those conversations to shift the way that I lead and I interact forever?
I really love that. And ladies and gents, if you're listening to this, I'm going to encourage you, even if you do like your current status quo, to still go back and challenge yourself and think, could we do this better? Is there a better way? Could I get more enjoyment, more fulfillment out of my practicing life? And I guarantee you the answer is yes.
Well, Jesse, I ask people to take a look at the status quo, where you are now.
Mm.
And I'm like, okay, let's imagine that you don't take this on. You don't want to become more coach-like. You don't want to introduce curiosity because that is a valid choice for lots of people.
Of course.
And I'm going to say, look, just imagine you don't take it on. And the language I use is prizes and punishments. What are the prizes and what are the punishments for you not taking this on?
Mm-hmm.
So the prizes will be something like this. I get to maintain my authority. I don't have people going, what's got into Jesse? He's now asking me questions the whole time.
Yep.
I don't have to listen to other people's stupid ideas or their stupid opinions about what I'm doing or not doing and what I'm doing wrong. I get to be the big boss of my practice. I basically get to maintain my comfort and my authority and my privilege and my familiarity and my sense of control as we carry on. And you can't underestimate that. That is the attraction to the status quo, and it is strong.
Yep.
And then you go, what's the price I'm paying? What would be the price I pay and others pay if I don't be more curious, if I don't ask better questions? What's the price I pay? Overdependent team, sense of overwhelm, sense of disconnect, what we talked about before. What does my practice manager pay? Sense of disempowerment, a sense of frustration, a sense of not being mentor and grown, a sense of I can get a better job somewhere else. What do my patients think? I'm just a cash cow for this dentist. They're just here. They give me the same old answer. Whatever I say costs me $600. Or this isn't a practice at all. This is just me being put through a treadmill and they extract a tooth and some cash from me. I mean, I'm exaggerating to make an effect. And I don't know anything about the dentistry business, so I'm just making stuff up here. So, you know.
No, but you're absolutely right. I think the prizes and the punishment is a really useful exercise to go through. And you have actually described it pretty well. But you did touch on a word around empowerment or disempowerment. And I wanted to just touch on that just for a second. Because we often talk about empowering people. And I wanted to ask you, because this is a thought that's been rattling around my brain for a little while, if we need to empower people, are they fundamentally disempowered to begin with? And are people generally born empowered or disempowered? And maybe this is a slightly philosophical question, but it kind of leads me to how people come into the business, how they're feeling at the outset, and how we treat them, and do we inadvertently disempower them, or are they already falling into that role themselves and it's up to us to kind of reimagine something new? So I wondered if you could just talk to that empowerment, disempowerment thing.
Well, I think that if you look around your practice, people have different levels of power and authority.
Mm.
And it's often subterranean. It's not something that shows up on your organizational chart or anything.
Yeah.
But there are definitely some people who have more power, more authority, more influence, and there's some people who don't.
Yep.
And I'm not sure I would say that everybody around you is disempowered, but I do think it's an interesting question to say, do I win if they feel more empowered?
Yeah, totally.
And I think often you do win, but actually not always in the short term. Because here's the sting in the tail around empowerment. Because, you know, it's like, well, who would be anti-empowerment? Well, nobody explicitly, or not many people explicitly, but implicitly, here's what empowerment involves. It means you giving up some of your authority, some of your influence, some of your control, some of your power. So there is a short-term price you pay.
Yes.
And prizes and punishments, is it worth it? It comes back to that, what we were weighing up before, which is like, okay, so now I don't get to decide everything. I've literally said to my practice manager, let me coach you through this, and it's your decision in the end on which way you go with this. Mm-hmm. And there's part of you going, this is a nightmare.
there's a few people going, oh, my God, I'm just, yeah. There's
a
few,
what am I doing with this?
Yeah.
And it also means going, what if they make a decision that's different from the one that I would make? What if I make a decision that is honestly, I feel worse than the one I would make?
Mm.
And then you're like, am I coaching them so that they know how to give me the answer that I'm looking for? And then you get into fake coaching questions like, have you thought of, or did you consider, or how about, none of which are actually coaching questions. They're just advice with a question mark attached on the end. But if you go, actually, I'm giving you the choice around this. This is yours to run. Here are the parameters. Here's what you can't lose. If any of these things get triggered, you need to talk to me about it.
Mm.
Here's what I'm reserving, which is like, if any of these things happen, I'm reserving the right to take back control and to make the decision.
Yep.
But empowerment says, I'm actually trusting you to make the decision. And I realize that in some ways that may not be as perfect a decision as I would have made. But I win anyway because it saves me 6 hours a week.
Yeah.
And it means that I can sleep at night. And even though I'm making 2% less than the decision I would have otherwise made, I've got somebody who is growing, somebody who's committed to my practice, somebody who's created more capacity within me so I can do better things that are more akin to my real purpose here. Mm. There's a bigger win to play for, perhaps.
I'm really loving that. And again, what I think will probably be reassuring to people listening to this is it's not a total handing over. There are some boundaries. No. There are limits to what you're going to be able to hand off to other people and having those checks and balances.
Right. I mean, I remember reading some US sea captain who, I've retired from the Navy, so I'm going to write a book and then talk about it endlessly. But he had a great distinction. He said, look, there are above the waterline mistakes and below the waterline mistakes. Mm. Below the waterline mistakes mean that your ship sinks, and that's a bad outcome for everybody. Mm. But above the waterline mistakes is how people grow and get wiser and smarter and more experienced. Mm. So you're like, okay, so what can you tolerate? And if you can't tolerate any mistakes, then you will always have a command and control. You won't avoid mistakes, but you'll just be able to punish people for them.
Yeah.
And you don't have a practice that has people who are growing and committed and learning and champions, and therefore that flows onto the patient experience and you build a brand that actually has resonance potentially.
Yeah. Michael, there's so many pearls of wisdom, so many gems in there. I do just want to shift gear for a moment to explore
a little bit. Michael, stop making up stuff about dentistry, which you don't know anything about.
No, it's really good. It's really good. And I'm an ex-Navy guy, so I'm loving the above and below the waterline. I'm just going, man, that's a great metaphor. That's awesome. But I do want to just talk a little bit about your background for a moment, because you've got an incredible background. You're a Rhodes Scholar. You've been to Oxford and studied there. And I wanted to just tie that back into curiosity again, because for me, the whole theme of today is about curiosity.
Sure.
And I wanted to ask you what you learned about curiosity being in such an institution like Oxford. Did you have that creative will, that creative space to explore things, or was it, being an institution, was it regimented? How did you navigate through that? And what did you take away from that experience?
Well, I took away two really tangible things from going to Oxford. The first is it saved me from becoming a lawyer. I did arts law at ANU.
Yeah.
I literally left the ANU being sued by one of my law school professors for defamation. So it wasn't going well. Momentum would carry on. You go and do whatever College of Law or whatever it's called, and then you become a lawyer. And then before you know it, I'd been an unhappy lawyer somewhere, Canberra or something.
Yeah.
So number one, it saved me from that. Secondly, and actually most importantly, I met my wife, who's Canadian, studying at Oxford. So it was a great experience on those two criteria alone. But honestly, I did a master's degree in literature, and it was a bit of an underwhelming experience, the actual courses that I took, for whatever reasons. I do remember that I had to submit my master's thesis on April the 25th. So as the introduction for that, I wrote this 5-page doggerel poem about how ironic it was that I was handing in this thesis on Anzac Day, which is also when a whole bunch of other Australians were sacrificed at the whims of random Englishmen.
How did that go?
I don't know. I'm not even that. The other thing I did was because you had to print a thesis and submit it. And so this is me in my contrarian insubordination way. I'm like, I found paper that had, which was hemp paper, and it had a marijuana leaf watermark. So my thought thesis, but enough of my childish rebellion. What was magical about Oxford is they throw you into kind of communal housing and you just live with really interesting people. I mean, some of them are not interesting because, it's humanity. But I remember one year I was living in a house and there were 15 people all doing PhDs.
Mm.
And some were historians and some were scientists and some were classic scholars and some were philosophers and some... And honestly, dinner timetable conversation was pretty outstanding.
Yeah.
I could barely hold on. I was doing a master's degree. I was living in the house because my girlfriend was doing a PhD, so she was hanging out with all these highfalutin people. And it was a opening up of an understanding about just different perspectives on life, different fields of study, different countries, because, there are people from India and Israel and Canada and all over, Tasmania, different countries. You know, it's always such an interesting people. So that, I think, was a really significant liberator for me, which was that exposure to different points of view.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the great joys in the world, is to have interesting conversations with interesting people. And for me, my whole, actually, you know, if you get into the whole Simon's Next Up with Why thing, my whole thing is interesting people, interesting conversation. And today has certainly ticked that box many, many times over, Michael. So thank you for...
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to come out and hang with us. But ladies and gents, if you want to find out more about what Michael does, please head across to his website, mbs.works. There is a treasure trove of goodies there. Michael's got a training company called Box of Crayons. I'd also encourage you to check that out if you'd like to. But get a hold of the books, The Advice Trap and The Coaching Habit. They are absolute pearls of wisdom and gems right there. So
I will say at mbs.works, if people want to check that out, there's a course there called The Year of Living Brilliantly. And it's 52 different teachers. Each have shot a 2 to 6 minute video. They basically, I just went around and talked to the most interesting people I can and said, give me your best thing in under 6 minutes on a video. So you get a kind of a new short video every week. And it's about kind of self-growth, self-learning, plus some tactical tools as well. And it's totally free. So if you're looking to find a really cheap way to expand your leadership capacity, or maybe share with your practice lead or business lead or whatever it might be, you'd be more than welcome to jump on. It's like 6,000 or 7,000 people on the community there. And so it's this rich learning, self-sufficient community as well.
Well, that's a really wonderful and generous offer. Thank you, Michael. I really hope people take that up, because I know just from our conversation today, it's going to be a rich tapestry of good stuff. So thank you, mate. And again, these two books, just on a personal note, they've been incredibly helpful for me. They've been incredibly helpful for our team. So thank you for taking the time to write them. And thank you for gritting through it, mate, because I know how bloody hard that is. So I really appreciate the battle scars you've incurred for the good of us. So that's wonderful.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jesse.
It's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. And look forward to catching up with you next time you're in Canberra, mate. We'll have to catch up and I'll shout your beer.
Sounds like a plan. Thanks, man.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.